Later, I'd feel certain that the number was 4358586. In the tent, there was a single telephone that hung from the wall, but it had no dial tone. Each morning, for the next 424 days, I would pick up the phone in hope that there would be one. But there never was, I said. That damn phone never worked.
You were there for 424 days?
You sounded like you didn't believe it. I counted.
That's almost 2 years.
14 months.
See, I told you it's too much to hear. It's not. I need to know.
I wanted to stop talking. But I also wanted to tell you. I said. The hours between lying down and getting up were a nightmare. The plane had touched down in darkness and sand. In the distance, swollen tents were boxed in by barbed wire. Big white boxes in a harsh sprawl of nothing. Texas, though I didn't know it then. The end point. The ultimate white you. Too cold in the winters and too hot in the summers. A mean, scorchful hot that grasped for rain. Heavy white plastic stretched over the tent's metal frame. Uneven concrete floors, like the cement had been poured in a hurry. The food looked sickly. Waxen bread, pasty oatmeal, noodles with fluorescent cheese. And because the dining area was next to the toilets, it all tasted like piss and shit. The sharp tang of urine eventually faded, leaving only hunger. And I ate milk and cheese that left me cramped on the toilet. The lights never turned off, so my eyeballs ached and throbbed. I'd lay in my bunk and hear Leon sleep-talking next to me in the bed we had shared. You and Michael next to us in the bed you had shared. And I'd curse at the guards in Fujianese. Fuck your mom! Fuck yourself! The worst part was you would think I abandoned you. When sleep did come, it was jagged and soundless. I'd wake to voices, not sure if it was hours or minutes later, and see a guard standing over me, marking a piece of paper. Bed check, the guard would say. I'm here, I'd respond in English. The tent was the length of a city block, but narrower. 200 women slept in two-person bunks grouped into 8 rows of 3 bunks each. We wore dark blue pants with elastic waistbands, baggy blue shirts, shoddy sewing, sloppy hems. None of us had any money and we couldn't get any, unless our families knew where we were. We could work on the cleaning crew, sweeping floors, scrubbing toilets, taking out trash for 50 cents a day. But there was a long waiting list to join. 73 names ahead of mine. The toilets and showers were in a large open stall ringed by a low wall that came up to my waist. Most days there wasn't any soap, and often no water. Hives broke out across my face, and a rash oozed up my arms, and my skin got raw and dry. In the middle of the tent was a glass octagon with tinted windows, where the guards watched us. They could see us, but we couldn't see them. I'd stand under the octagon stepladder and wave. I asked the guards for a lawyer, for immigration, but they told me to wait. No one offered advice or answers. Some women didn't speak any English,
and others spoke in such rapid English I couldn't keep up. Any day now, I kept telling myself, Dee Dee and Leon would find me and get me out of here. On the 12th day, a Chinese woman with freckles came up to me in the oatmeal line and said in Mandarin,
Come eat with me. I'm Lei.
I was so happy to talk to someone, I wanted to kiss her. Over oatmeal, I found out Lei was originally from Shandong and had been in the tent for almost 18 months. She'd gotten a speeding ticket in Chicago and was shipped off to ICE. 18 months! I'd been trying so hard to tamp down my panic by picturing myself back home with you. These 12 days just a blip in our regular routines. Thinking of these routines comforted me. Cooking dinner with Vivian. Riding the train to work. Telling you and Michael to shut the TV off and go to bed. Now that hope of returning was being yanked away. I can't be here for that long. I have a family, and they don't even know I'm here. I looked around at the tables of women scooping up clumps of oatmeal with their hands. There were never enough forks or spoons.
There are some women who've been here a lot longer, Lei said. There's a woman named Mary who's lived in America since she was 6 months old. Born in Sudan. Was in college. Had a travel visa. Got arrested at the airport after coming home from studying in France. The government says her parents never adjusted her immigration status when she was a baby, and she needs a physical examination to complete her application to change her status. Of course, an exam costs $300, and they won't give it to her at Ardsleyville. And she can't access her bank account because ICE put a hold on her name.
Lei shook her head.
Typical.
Nobody knew anything. There were too many cases in the immigration courts, Lei said. And we didn't get things like lawyers. Only a judge who decided if you would stay or go. None of us knew when we would see this judge. If the authorities would release us from custody. Where we would end up. I was so sleepy. Sleepy all the time. My legs ached from not walking enough. Once or twice a week, the guards let us out into the courtyard for an hour. A rectangle ringed by barbed wire. Large enough for us to stand no more than an arm's length apart. Beyond that was a giant American flag, flapping in the hot wind. And an open yard surrounded by more wire, which housed a separate prison that Lei called the Hole. The men were in other tents beyond that. Tents we couldn't see. There were days I stayed in bed, itching under the blanket. I assumed the sun was still swapping seats with the moon every 12 hours, though for all I knew the sky could have become green. The sun now square. The stars extinguished and smeared like mosquitoes on the underside of a slipper.
Deming, Deming, your name hammered a drumbeat between my eyes. I had wanted to move, and now you would think I left on purpose. I scratched my arm so hard the skin broke into angry red snarls. You might forget my face. The next time I saw you, your voice might be lower. Leon might find another woman. I had the ring he gave me, and I twisted it around my finger, felt it pinch my skin. Starry night. Grassy field. Cricket chorus. Clucking chicken. You. I tried to visualize all the things I loved. If I produced more saliva, I could pretend I wasn't so thirsty. Glass of water. Cup of tea. Wet kisses. Leon.
I tried to relax, hoping for a few hours of sleep before the first bed check. Warm hands. Loud music. You. I told Lei about you. How good your English was. The way you took care of Michael. But every day I worried more. Were you doing okay in school? Was Vivian feeding you enough? And were your clothes clean? You needed a new pair of shoes. Your feet were growing so fast. You couldn't walk if your shoes were too tight. And who would buy you shoes? How could you walk?
Weeks. Then months passed. I lay on my back in the top bunk. There wasn't enough space to lie in any position except on my back and perfectly still. A lesson I'd learned when I rolled off the bunk and fell onto the floor. I pulled the blanket over my face, exposing my feet. Then I got up and went to eat with Lei. She was sitting with a woman named Samara, who was from Pakistan. The three of us could communicate using the spotty English we knew. Some of the women were planning a protest, Samara said. There were church people who led a vigil outside the tent. And somehow Mary, the woman who'd lived in America since she was a baby, had gotten in touch with them. The guards won't care if we protest, I said.
I saw what they did to people who protested before you came, Lei said. Three guards kicked these women until they bled. Then they got deported. What makes you think it's going to be different now?
Day 203. Sunlight blazed onto the tent roof. I sat on my bunk, reached under my shirt sleeves, applied nails to skin, and scratched. I knew my arms were already inflamed and split red, but scratching produced the sweetest pain, the most exquisite fire. When I scratched, I could dig my fingernails into all the unspoken words of the past months. I began to hate Leon and Didi, to want to forget them. Had they even tried to find me? Maybe it was better this way, to pretend they didn't exist. Missing them was worse. So was waiting. We made a plan. When the guards led us into the courtyard, we weren't coming back in. One woman would deliver a list of our complaints. The church group had gotten in touch with journalists, who would come and film us so that Americans would learn about the tents. The government would shut down Ardsleyville and we could go home. I didn't think it would be that easy. But we had to try something. It was better to participate than to acknowledge we had no options. Lei refused to be a part of it. After lunch, the guards unlocked the door to the yard and we walked outside. After a few minutes, we began to move around, changing from bunches to lines and corners. We spelled out letters. H-E-L-P. So that the news helicopters could see us from above. I stepped behind Samara, rolling my sleeves up in the heat. Your skin is broken, Samara said. It looks painful. I pulled my sleeves back down. It's nothing, I said. We stood for a long time, waiting for something to happen. For the church people. The journalists. But nothing happened except the guards got angry, yelling at us to go in. Lei and the other women on the opposite side of the yard returned to the tent. Samara and I stayed standing. The sky remained blue and still. There were no birds in the desert.
No cars driving on a nearby highway.
No cool ocean lapping my ankles. Only hot sky.
Then I heard it. A buzz slicing the air.
The buzz grew louder, and I saw a shape circling the clouds. A blue dot no larger than a bird. And the bird grew bigger, and the buzz was thundering.
But when the plane flew away, the silence was monstrous.
"We haven't figured out what to do after this," I said to Samara. Guards with helmets and plastic shields pushed into the yard. And as the air filled with burning, my eyes seared and my tongue became bitter. I could only see clouds and helmeted men. I felt a stick in the side and hit the ground hip first.
The length of my new room was 11 footprints up and 8 across. All those months in the tent, waiting in line for the toilets, and now I could spend a week sitting on a toilet by myself. There was a mattress on a concrete shelf, a chair shaped from a concrete block, and a little light that was forever on. 3 times a day, the steel door on the front wall would open and a tray would push through the slot like a tongue protruding out a mouth.
"I am breakfast,"
I imagined the mouth saying.
"Hello, I'm lunch."
The tray contained a brown slab. Breakfast or lunch, a slab. Dinner, a slab. It tasted like mush. I talked to the mouth as I shoved the empty trays back.
"Do you like how that feels, big mouth? You like it. You love it."
3 times a week, the guards would thread a chain around my ankle, another around my waist. 3 hours a week, I was allowed outside, in a cage inside a yard surrounded by tall walls. My legs and arms sore from not moving. My eyes sore at having to focus so far. Unused to seeing anything farther than 11 footprints up and 8 across. Sometimes I'd see traces of others. Was that shape Mary? Samara? But I never saw anyone close enough to be sure. Against my will, I'd think of your smile ripping open as we rode the subway, of the words that had dripped and skipped so easily on Polly's tongue, delivered without having to strain or translate. I thought of Pelan kissing Haifeng, how Pelan's body had been so new that she would catch a glimpse of herself in a window and think, "Yeah, that's me." When Pelan was supposed to be doing the wash, she would brush her hair for hours until it shone. Linger outside so her hair could catch the light and drink it in. The walls were a lie. A trick. I could pull them apart with my hands. Gentle and determined. Like pulling a shirt over a child's head. Blow on the floor until it fell away, and then I would be in the grass. Sunshine rolling up my body, lapping at my fingers. The sun would have a tongue, nice and fat, licking slow and lazy. And the grass would smell like worms and dirt. My body would pick up speed as I rolled, bouncing into the air, soaring over hills and oceans. There was my house, Yiba in the yard with chickens. I'd arch up, kick my legs, and coast. Because I wasn't really here. This was the life of another person I was watching in a movie, saying, "What a pity. Oh, that poor woman. Oh, I'm so glad that isn't me." I pushed at the walls with my head. I'd crack them open so I could return to you. Keep you with me. They bandaged my skull,
clucking at my head and scratched-up arms. And for days it felt like my brain was sprouting nails. In a room with long rows of chairs and tables, I listened to a young man in a suit talk through wire mesh, his collar damp with sweat, his words muffled through the grating. I couldn't tell what language he was speaking. The last person I had spoken to was a guard. The person before that, a guard. The man in the suit said, "Lawyer," in Mandarin. As he spoke, he gestured with his hands, and I imagined them around my neck, and I screamed. I don't know how many days later. I was in a van as it moved down a highway, and my eyes watered at the sudden sunlight. Then I was in a room with windows. The space so long I could sense myself falling. One by one, men in blue pants and shirts walked to the front of the room to speak to an older man who introduced himself as the judge. When it was my turn, the judge spoke to me, but he talked so fast I couldn't tell what he was saying. A white woman was next to me in a brown suit, waiting for a reply. I dredged up one word and turned to the woman.
"Why?"
The judge slammed his hand on the podium.
"You don't talk."
"What is your name?"
the judge asked in English.
"Guo Peilan,"
I said.
"Polly Guo."
He slammed his hand down again. The woman in the suit spoke in Mandarin. "You need to wait for my translation."
"What is your name?"
asked the judge again. And again I answered before the woman had spoken.
"You need to wait for my translation," the woman repeated. "You can't answer his question until I translate it."
"But what am I doing here?"
"They want to deport you, but they need to get the right documents first."
"They can't do that. Where's my lawyer? I have a son here. He's an American citizen."
The judge said something I couldn't hear.
"Dismissed,"
the woman said.
"You spoke out of turn. He's going to issue an order of deportation that says you didn't show up today because you spoke out of turn."
"But I showed up!"
The ride back to Ardsleyville was hot and shaky. A man in an officer's uniform asked me to mark a paper printed with English words. I wrote my name on the line. Back in my room, the walls dissolved and I stepped outside. I was becoming someone else again. I remembered a solitary light blinking on the tip of the plane's wing. The man in the next seat jiggling his knees like he was about to jump out of his pants. It was night. I shivered, sweating, couldn't remember the last time I'd eaten. And then I leaned over and vomited on my shoes. Two uniformed men ushered me off the plane with a 20-yuan bill and a newly issued ID. There were people around me speaking in Mandarin, Fuzhonese.
"Where are we?"
I asked one of the men in Mandarin.
"Fuzhou, Changle."
"There's no airport in Changle."
"There is now."
I found a door and pushed it open. I stood on the curb, nauseous, as mopeds and cars roared around me, the noise deafening, thunderous. And as I took a step forward, a moped zoomed past, nearly knocking me over. The uniformed men had said I could go. But where? There could still be guards watching. It was a cloudy morning in November. or January. And the air was packed with smells I recognized. Memories of the village. Burning wood and paper ashes. Roast meat and salt. A brackish odor. Swampy and thick with a tinge of rot. The scent of the riverbank. Was this for real? Or was it a trick? I needed to find you. A minibus for Minjiang pulled up. The driver, a woman whose hair was arranged into long, curly ribbons, opened the door. I stared at her. She said,
"You getting in or what?"
I paid for a ticket with the 20 yuan bill, sat by the window, and watched the road disappear behind me as we drove away from the airport. Nobody was following. For weeks, months, years, whenever I turned a new corner or opened a door, I'd expect to be ambushed by guards. Even now, I can't trust that they won't come for me someday. The entrance arches of the village were far wider than they'd been 20 years ago. Extensions built onto the top and sides. And there were new street signs and lamp posts. The dirt roads were all paved. I passed chickens and trucks and bicycles, plastic sheeting strung between poles, posters on the walls announcing new development projects. I searched the face of each person I saw, dreading the moment I'd recognize someone and wishing someone would recognize me. And although some people looked familiar, I couldn't identify anyone I knew. After 20 years away, nobody looked the same. At a newspaper stand, I picked up the morning paper and saw the date on top. It was April, but the year was different. I had counted the days correctly. 14 months had disappeared while I was at Ardsleyville. I felt faint. My head spun. I searched the newspaper vendor's face, hoping for a sign of recognition. But none appeared. On Three Alley, the lane was cleanly swept and there was a fresh coat of paint on my old house. I tried to open the door, but it was locked. I knocked, and Mrs. Lee answered. Dressed in a lavender sweatsuit printed with dark flowers.
Pei Lan, what are you doing here?
What are you doing in my house?
We've been using it. My cousin and his family live here, though they went home to the countryside last week for the holiday. Are you back for the holiday?
What holiday?
Qingming.
Mrs. Lee drew her words out slowly, eyeing my Ardsleyville uniform.
You're using my land? My house?
You were in America. We couldn't contact you.
I didn't give it to you.
You can stay if you want.
It's not for you to decide.
I pushed past her. The inside of the house had also been repainted. My old room was full of the belongings of Mrs. Lee's countryside cousin and his wife. Mr. Lee had died 8 years ago, and Haifeng and his wife had a son of their own, a 5-year-old whose photographs Mrs. Lee showed me. I was relieved to notice he didn't resemble you. Neighbors came by, though I couldn't remember most of their names, and they looked shocked when they saw me. Had I changed so much? I told them I'd come home because there weren't many jobs in New York. That you were staying with relatives until you finished school. To have been detained for over a year was embarrassing. Like I'd been caught out of stupidity. And I couldn't let anyone know. Mrs. Lee gave me a pink sweatsuit to wear. I roamed the village without hitting a fence or a wall, swinging my arms and legs, gulping in the clean air. At the temple, I saw my name next to Yiba's on a plaque with the names of villagers who'd given money for repairs. Yiba must have donated with the money I sent home. I ate meat and rice and vegetables and not oatmeal. Heard music and cars and people. Walked for hours without guards ordering me inside. I tucked blades of grass between my toes and pressed my thumbs against leaves and bark. The dirt smelled sweet, and the breeze was as soft and clean as freshly laundered sheets. But the house was no longer my house. Mrs. Lee's cousin had a little girl, and her books and clothes were strewn across the room downstairs. Yiba's television was gone, a new one in its place. I found, hidden in a corner beneath the bed, one of your old shoes. I had bought them for you that first winter in New York, before sending you here. I held the tiny gray sneaker in my palm, remembered slipping it onto your little foot, pulling the laces tight. You must have been wearing it on the flight from New York. Dirt had settled into the creases, and the sole left my palm blackened with dust. I couldn't find the other shoe. That night, I slept in my house. The next morning, I took a bus to Fuzhou with 5,000 yen that Mrs. Lee had given me for taking over my house. Later, I would learn that the house was worth at least 15,000, even 20. But by then it wouldn't matter. Downtown Fuzhou looked nothing like it had 20 years ago. Fountains spurted in a square, surrounded by statues of men and women with their arms raised, with faces that looked oddly European. People walked past me in business suits. In a telephone booth, I called the number for the loan shark, which I'd gotten from a neighbor on Three Alley, and told the man who I was, my birth date, how much I had paid off before leaving New York, that I was in China and wanted to know the balance.
"One moment,"
he said.
"Let me check."
I waited. Then the man got back on the phone and said,
"Your debt has been paid. Your balance is now zero."
I bit my fingers. Leon must have wired my payments, month after month, when I was in Ardsleyville. I bought an international calling card and dialed Leon's number, the one I thought I remembered. The phone rang twice and disconnected. No answer. No voicemail. I tried again and again and again and again. I stayed in the phone booth, attempting different combinations of phone numbers, all the numerical combinations that could possibly be Leon's. But none of them was the right one. I even dialed my old cell, a number I did remember, which was answered by a teenage girl. I had never memorized the numbers for Didi or Hello Gorgeous. With each dead-end phone call, my optimism receded, until I was crying into the sleeve of Mrs. Lee's sweatsuit. You were lost. My family was lost. 14 months had disappeared, and I didn't even have a place to live. It was hunger that finally drove me out of the phone booth and into a nearby food stall, where I ate until the shakiness retreated and my despair hardened into ambition. Mrs. Lee had mentioned a nail salon, one of the first in Wuyi Square,
and I found the address and introduced myself to the owner, a woman whose French manicure was flaking at the tips.
I worked in New York, I told her. Give me 10 minutes and I can draw your face on your thumbnail.
By nightfall, I had a job and a rented bed in a building full of Sichuanese workers. 18. A door slammed down the hotel hallway, followed by the sounds of footsteps. I stopped, mid-sentence, and heard two women talking, their voices fading as they walked toward the elevator, and felt like I had woken up from a trance. You'd ask me to tell you the truth. And now that I had, you looked like you wished I hadn't. You couldn't call me because I was already in Ridgeboro, you said. I know that now. But back then, I was so worried.
But you found Leon. You even saw him. Didn't he tell you I was adopted?
I tried to figure out what I should say.
You knew, and didn't do anything?
I didn't find him, I said. He found me. Every week, on my one day off, I looked for Leon's family. If I found them, they could put me in touch with him, and he would put me in touch with you. I had to keep believing this. So I took a minibus to Leon's village and went to the homes of all the Zhengs in the phone book. Imagine how long that took. But nobody knew who he was. To get to the district government office, I had to take 2 city buses followed by a minibus and then walk through a wasteland of parking lots. Then I waited outside a squat building in the humidity, sweating through my one clean outfit. The door was always closed, the blinds pulled tight. The silence was eerie and there was no shade, only sunlight on bare asphalt. Finally, the door would open and an official would walk out. "Excuse me," I would say, as they walked past me. I'd wait until they got back from their breaks. It could be 5 minutes, or 2 hours, and I had to intercept them fast before they disappeared into the building. I learned to bring a bag of peanuts for lunch and a bottle of water, to speak politely yet forcefully, smiling to evoke both urgency and empathy.
"I'm looking for the family of Leon Zheng. I'm his wife. We got separated. I need to find his family."
After the first few visits, the officials recognized me, and they'd flinch when they saw me waiting, avoiding my eyes.
"Miss Guo," one man said, "I told you last week that family registration records were classified. Unless you found your marriage certificate..."
"I'll come back again. I'll call tomorrow."
I went each week and called every day until a man said if I didn't stop asking, they would arrest me. For months, I only spoke if I had to, avoiding the other women at the boarding house, who treated me with suspicion and spoke to one another in Sichuanese. I had 2 outfits, and washed each one in the sink at night after wearing it, hung it to dry on a rack I'd constructed out of dowels and rubber bands. I worked as much as I could, until I was too tired to be overrun by guilt, fury, and crushing sadness. Sometimes, painting a woman's nails, I'd suddenly want to scream. And on breaks, I'd go into the bathroom stall and do exactly that, stuffing my fingers into my mouth so no one could hear. The weeks melted by. Days off were the worst, because there'd be no work to distract me, and my mind was fresh enough to cough up memories of you and Leon and Ardsleyville.
The hours spent waiting outside the government office were an opportunity to berate myself until I wished a bus would swerve off the street and flatten me. I started working 7 days a week. I did a double take in the bathroom mirror when I saw the mournful, wounded expression on my face, like I'd been permanently punched. But it also seemed a fitting punishment. One afternoon, after I had been in China for about 6 months, I was painting some lady's toenails when I noticed a strange man in the salon. I returned to the toenails, but could sense him walking closer. And when I looked up, I saw the gap between his front teeth and let a blob of polish fall on my knee.
"Little star,"
he said. I finished the pedicure as fast as I could, asked a co-worker to take my next customer, and led Leon outside and down the block. He said that one of the Zhengs in his home village, a man I'd left the salon's address with, had run into him in Ma Wei. We found an alleyway and put our arms around each other. And when I pressed my cheek to his, the smell of his skin was exactly the same. Musty and sweet. So beautiful. Familiar. When was the last time anyone had held me? Too long ago. It had been Leon, before I'd been taken to Ardsleyville. I held him tighter, spoke into his neck. "Where's Deming? Is he with you?"
"I need to tell you something."
Leon spoke at the wall. "He told me how you had been adopted by a white couple. Americans, in New York. Vivian had arranged it. She hadn't known how to get in touch with me. And they'd thought I was never coming back."
"I should have never left,"
he said.
"If I hadn't left, he would still be with me. It's my fault. I don't know how to get in touch with him."
I heard Leon sniffle, and then the sound of my own crying. I yelled at him, blamed him, called him the worst names I could. For the past 6 months, I'd been alternating between holding out hope that I would find you and trying to accept that you were gone. Leon drove me to the boarding house and I got my things. We went to a small apartment on the eastern edge of the city, which belonged to a friend who was out of town. I asked him why we weren't going to his apartment, and he said,
"I need to tell you something else."
And he did. The first night we were together, I jolted awake. Fluorescent lights, a guard with a notepad. I felt a hand on my arm and shouted out loud,
"Little star! Little star!"
I saw Leon's face. It was a repeating nightmare. The screaming in my sleep that my roommates complained about. The walls of the hole. The weight of the handcuffs around my wrists and ankles. Leon kissed me.
"You're here with me now."
We only left the apartment for food. Takeout meals we ate at the kitchen table naked, taking quick showers only to end up in bed again. Leon's cell phone rang occasionally, but he rarely answered. And when he did, he was considerate enough to take the call in another room. The third afternoon, he went out and came back with a bottle of pills. And that night, my nightmares were blotted away. Sleep reduced to a dark, blank square. It was only 5 days. A fever dream. And by the end, we were exhausted but still coming together. Like two tired magnets that gravitated toward one another out of habit. or lack of choice. As long as we stayed in this room, time wouldn't go on. We could pretend that 2 years hadn't passed since we'd last seen each other, that we weren't avoiding questions, that you weren't missing. You being gone like that, given over to another family like a stray dog, was too much to comprehend. And it hovered, like the rest of the world, just out of reach. I'd heard of a rural couple who had tried to get their daughter back from a family who had adopted her, but had gotten thrown in jail. I thought of taking all the pills at once, took them out of the bottle and counted them. There were 35. And put them back inside. Maybe you could still find me. As long as we stayed inside, your adoption would not be real. But Leon's friend was coming home the next day and we would have to leave the apartment.
I could come with you,
Leon said. We were eating breakfast in a bakery, had gone out to wash the sheets and towels.
We could be together again.
He held his arms across the table, his fingers wrapping around mine. An ambulance drove past, and I jumped at the sound of the sirens. The past 5 days had been a delusion. He was asking me to stay with him because he thought it was what I wanted to hear. But he already had a family. I could see the relief in his face when I told him no. Because being with Leon made your loss real. Go home to your wife, I told him. The first day we had been together, I thought I could make him choose. But by the fifth day, I no longer wanted to. Go home to your baby girl. You slid down the wall until you were buried under the hotel sheets.
And that was it,
you said.
You forgot me.
I didn't forget. I just survived. I took a class in business Mandarin so I could bury my village accent and get a better job. When the teacher heard I had lived in America, he said he was also opening up an English school. I told him I'd studied in New York and gone to America on a student visa. Even if my English wasn't good, it was better than some of the other teachers.
Working for World Top can't get you an urban hukou right now,
Boss Cheng said, after I moved into the teacher dormitory.
But we'll see about the future.
I decided I would work this job, make a lot of money, and figure out a way to go back to New York so I could find you. I'd been teaching at World Top for almost a year, working and saving as much as I could, when Yong appeared in my class. He didn't manage to learn much from me, but on the night of his last class, he said in English,
I'd like to see you sometime.
He started to take me out to dinner twice a week, a few hours during which my grief would retreat, a momentary break. I liked his steadiness, his ambition and kindness. I'd forgotten what it was like to have someone pay attention to me, to have someone to talk to. Here was someone who could be a partner. And this was my chance to marry into an urban hukou, to get a permanent city residency permit. Without one, I'd always be a migrant. The city could kick me out any time. Those 5 days with Leon, the feeling of the floor dropping out from beneath me, that could never happen again. After 2 months, I kissed Yong. 6 months later, we had our wedding at a hotel in Wuyi Square. 12 courses were served. 8 of them seafood.
There wasn't anything I could do, I said. I couldn't go back to America after being deported. I couldn't go anywhere. If I thought about you too much, I wouldn't be able to live.
I knew how it must sound to you. I hadn't tried hard enough. I didn't love you enough. But I could have kept looking forever. I needed you to understand.
You forgot me,
you said.
No! Never!
You didn't even tell your husband about me.
I did tell him. You met him. You know.
You didn't tell him until I called you.
My head sagged. You were right. I thought he'd be angry. And then he would leave me. But that, too, was a lie. I'd only told myself that. I had never believed it.
I thought you went away because I did something wrong. I was a kid!
You pounded the mattress with your fists. You must have wanted to punch me, too.
You didn't do anything wrong, I said. When I returned to China and learned Leon had paid off the rest of my debt, I knew you were okay. Even if I hated the idea of you calling a white lady Mama or Mom.
You snorted.
Leon didn't pay off the loan shark. Vivian did.
Now I felt like I had really been punched.
But you were safe, weren't you? With your adoptive parents? I could hear the pleading desperation in my own questions. How badly I wanted to believe you'd been fine. That I had done all I could.
There was a long silence. Finally, you said,
I never call my adoptive mother Mama or Mom.
You shut off the light. For a moment, we lay together, on our separate beds, as your words pulled a warm blanket over us and made us less alone. 19. He hadn't expected to like teaching so much. Today he split his students out into groups of 3 for role-playing, ordering at a restaurant, asking for directions in English. The other instructors, even his mother, laughed at him for making work harder for himself and not teaching the workbook. But his students were awake, engaged, and he was willing to be held up for their amusement and curiosity. When he said they could ask him anything they wanted, as long as they asked in English, they shouted out questions. What kind of clothes did people wear in New York? What did they eat? Did he have a girlfriend? Boss Chung had reprimanded him, said his class was too noisy. But when Daniel's students told their friends about him and these new students enrolled and requested to be in his class, Boss Chung stopped bugging him.
Boss Chung doesn't know his head from his ass,
his mother said, cackling her old laugh. He leaned toward her compliments, always craving more.
You're the best teacher at that school. You should be director.
That was her new plan for him. He'd stay in Fuzhou, follow her footsteps. It made him feel proud, yet also unsure. He didn't know if he wanted to be the director of World Top English. But then she would look at him and smile, and he would smile back, thinking,
yes, this is where I belong.
He had been living in China for 3 months. Hadn't spoken to Peter and Kay since leaving Ridgeboro in August. People no longer laughed at his accent. His Mandarin and Fujianese had slipped back into native speaker levels. and the gaps between translating and speaking had grown smaller and smaller until they were nearly imperceptible, his brain automatically shifting into Chinese. His tourist visa was expiring soon, and his mother was in the process of sponsoring him for a real work visa. The forms had been in his room for weeks, and he needed to fill them out. Until then, he couldn't legally receive a salary. Wasn't on the official payroll at World Top English. But Boss Cheng paid his mother extra money, which she then deposited into his bank account. After his morning class, Daniel went out for lunch with two of the other teachers, Eddie and Tammy. They usually insisted on McDonald's or Pizza Hut, places where he would never voluntarily eat. Today they were going to a spaghetti restaurant that Tammy said was sophisticated, though Daniel would have been fine going to a noodle stall and slurping down a cheap bowl of soup. They walked the three blocks from World Top to the restaurant. Daniel familiar with most of the streets in downtown Fuzhou, accustomed to mopeds coming at him in all directions. The summer in Ridgeboro. The liminal New York winter that had preceded it. Seemed like another lifetime ago. It was astounding to think that that had been him, tromping across the ice on Canal Street, not knowing that by the end of the year, he would have not only seen his mother again but be living with her, seeing her every day. Inside the restaurant, an old song was looping on the speaker, the moon hitting the singer's eye like a big pizza pie. The waitresses wore red, white, and green uniforms. It was a macaroni grill on steroids. Eddie climbed into the banquette next to him.
Is the menu authentic?
Outside of class, they spoke Fujianese. Daniel flipped through the pictures of pastas drowning in red and white sauces. If it wasn't a Chinese restaurant, Tammy and Eddie always made him order.
Yes,
he said. Tammy brushed her bangs away from her eyes. Unlike Eddie, she avoided eye contact at all costs.
Restaurants where the waitresses wear uniforms are always authentic. Deming, you order for all of us.
Daniel asked the waitress for three bowls of spaghetti and meatballs and a platter of garlic sticks.
Eddie's unblinking gaze felt like being cross-examined.
Tammy said she'd heard that the restaurant served the best American food in Fuzhou.
This food isn't American,
Eddie said.
Well, it's Italian,
Daniel said.
But the dishes are more of an American style. They would call it Italian-American.
Tammy said, But is it Italian or American?
It's both.
But Italians aren't American,
Eddie said.
Sure, they can be Italian-American. Like if your parents were born in Italy, but you were born in America.
Then you'd be American, Tammy said. Because you were born in America.
Well, you can be Chinese-American. I'm Chinese-American because I was born in America.
But you have a Chinese face, so that makes you Chinese, Tammy said.
Americans can have Chinese faces. They aren't only white people.
Tammy and Eddie glanced at each other, and Eddie muttered a quick sentence in Fujianese that Daniel couldn't catch.
I'm right here, you know, Daniel said. I can hear you talking about me.
We're not talking about you, Tammy said.
The tomato sauce was too sweet, the pasta overcooked, and Daniel ached for a proper New York thin slice. Folded in half and chowed down while standing at an oily pizzeria counter. Tonight, he'd pick up food on the way home and eat in front of the TV. If he was in Manhattan or Ridgeboro, his friends would be buying him shots. But instead he would return to an empty apartment. His mother was supposed to be coming home late, on the bullet train from Xiamen, where she had spent the last 2 days for work. She no longer watched him so carefully, like he was in danger of vanishing. And on weekends they spent hours walking around the city together, having long, easy meals, and he would feel warm and full. But when she made plans for him, mentioned people she wanted him to meet or a trip they might take in the future, he would feel